So I get long-winded answer, and Andy, as always, because I can't help myself. But the
No, it's a good
reality,
answer.
yeah, but the reality is that it's a very complicated information space, and Sol, I think, is the model in many ways, which is to say, I have my principles, I have my theories, and then here's the data.
Yeah.
We'll see if it, you know. And again, going back to the inflation thing, do I think inflation is going to stay low under this, in this environment? No, because I think oil is fundamentally underpriced.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and so for that reason, like, but I got news for you. Oil prices can go to $75 a barrel. Gasoline or RBOB gasoline futures can move from 210 or 212 a gallon to 230 a gallon. Gas prices here in Florida will go back up over $3 a gallon. Inflation will go up. And guess what? And guess what you'll see? I'll tell you exactly what you'll see.
Tom Luongo, good afternoon to you, my friend. I said off camera, there's not a person I would rather talk to right now than you. So I'm very happy and grateful to have you on. I want to start out with what's going on with the tariffs and just work me through that because it's creating a lot of havoc in the world. What's your view on this? And let's game this out.
Sure. Let's start with the fun part. I just watched a 15-minute video of Thomas Sowell, the great
Great man.
Sowell, right? Austrian economist, free marketeer, going, having to cope his way through the fact that Trump won with tariffs. And I find it kind of, and don't get me wrong, I'm not dissing on Thomas Sowell in any way, manner, shape, or form. But it felt to me like after like the first couple of minutes of his chat on this, I'm like, you're restating the same thing over and over and over again in order to try and convince yourself that you were wrong. Sol's argument, and he's not wrong about this, is that Trump was able to introduce chaos and then resolve it. And he focused on the fact that he understood that he had a plan, which was to introduce chaos, change the rules of the game, use tariffs strategically to get what he wanted, i.e. leverage, and then cut new deals, roll them back to some reasonable level, and figure things out from there. And the proof in the pudding is that the inflation numbers have come in and they're reasonably good. Now, we're very early into all this process. Oil prices are in the dumps, right? The more I watch the oil markets, and this, bear with me on this, is on the inflation point. The more I watch the oil markets, the more I realize that the oil price is completely manipulated. But the Brent crude contract is not indicative of reality. And that's fine. I don't know who's manipulating at this point. During the Biden junta, it was very obvious they were trying to bring oil prices down in order to, you know, get themselves reelected, and they drained the SPR to put us in a strategically weak position, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, all the stuff that we've talked about previously. And now we're going to start the process of refilling the SPR and use, and I saw this on Zero Hedge like literally 20 minutes ago. The Republicans have put in a $1.5 billion bill to refill the SPR by using money that was earmarked for some green stuff that they're getting rid of. So, like, the money's being repurposed, right? Fine. But, you know, depending on what you're, I'm not a huge fan of CPI inflation, never have been. Daniel DeMartino Booth is a big fan of trueflation. I look at the two of them. I do my thing. And trueflation has been rising over the last couple of weeks back up towards 2%. It had already created a crater down towards, you know, less than 1%. So, you know, CPI is a lagging indicator. So everybody's able to now get an effect for Thomas Sowell. He's able to get a data point that he can use as a means by which to say, I was wrong on tariffs. Now, the big question is he going to be effectively, is the theory going to be right on tariffs in the long run, that they're going to be inflationary and raise costs and all this other stuff? I don't know. That's going to be up to historians and posterity and everything else. The reality is that we had a very unbalanced system where the United States consumer ran the global economy and was paying for it. And that's unacceptable. I mean, soup to nuts, that's the funnel. That's kind of the final TLDR on the whole thing. And Trump was right about all that. Like it or not, I'm a free marketeer. I don't like taxes. I think taxes are theft. All of it, like, you know, fine. But, you know, we live in a world of nation states. We live in a world of communities and cultures. And at this point in time, you know, theory is nice. And then there's the world we have to live in. And the truth of the matter is that you've got states out there that engage in protectionism. And they have central banks, which they can use to manipulate their currencies. They have a warfare and a welfare state. And the whole free marketeer tariff argument is an extension of the old open borders argument that derives directly out of the non-aggression principle and all this nonsense that peaceable people should be able to cross arbitrary political borders without hindrance. Fine. Sounds great in theory. Even Murray Rothbard said, oh, by the way, the non-aggression, the open borders is inconsistent with the existence of a welfare and warfare state. It's a consequence of people leveling up ethically, morally, in such that we don't need the state to protect us. We all live in a kind of world of relative harmony. Relative harmony. I also, over the years of being a hardcore libertarian, have always made the argument that you can't eliminate psychopathy and psychopathic behavior. You can only minimize it. There are going to be people who cheat the system. There are going to be people who try to steal from other people. There are going to be thieves. There are going to be murderers. There are going to be idolaters and all of the rest of it. And your goal is to minimize them. And adherence to principle and philosophy without taking into consideration what is and is not the path to minimization is foolish. If not foolish, it's childish. And the temper tantrum that I'm seeing from Thomas Massey and Rand Paul and this one and that one, and everybody, they're all just playing frankly, childish game. And Trump is right to call Massey out as a grandstander. Doesn't have a strategic bone in his body. And every freaking person that I would have considered a friend, philosophically, emotionally, morally, and everything else. By the way, I'm not on their dance cards anymore. Why? Because they don't want to talk to me anymore because they know I'm right. Because they want to hold on to their principles, scream into the void, build nothing, and fix nothing. And it's why I opened this with the discussion about Thomas Sowell. Because what I've always liked about Thomas Sowell, there's the data. Here's the situation. Here's the theory. Theory's not applicable. It's working. Mazel tov. For those of you who think I'm a Jew, which I'm not. Because I just happen to be Italian and from New York. There's not that much difference at the end of the day. I know how to confess with the best of them. So Trump introduced chaos. He did so strategically in the mix of, and again, to Sowell's points, of wanting to deregulate, wanting to lower taxes, other taxes, wanting to reshape how we spend money and reorganize the economy and reorganize the global economy such that the American consumer is allowed to, and I mean this sincerely, allowed to exercise their leverage over the producers. Mm-hmm. And somehow that's anathema to free market economics. Bullshit. Just that's bullshit, especially in this world of a near total surveillance state, of insane levels of social welfare spending and military spending and this and that and everything else. All these things that are anathema to free market economics. Mm-hmm. Like, it's one thing to argue about, and I've made this kind of comparison in the past, right? When I've said, I think I might have been talking to Stormy Waters about this or something. I've made this argument in the past. the way we practice economic activity in the world today is very bounded. I, being a scientist, a quantum mechanics kind of guy, I look at it as the classic particle in the box argument, the thought experiment, which is the basis for deriving the Schrodinger equation and all of quantum mechanics, which is that you have a particle inside a box with infinitely high, infinitely high walls, and those are the boundary conditions of the problem. Inside the box, we're allowed to act, we're allowed and actively encouraged to act like free marketeers. But the boundaries of the box itself determine the limit as to which we can profit from our free market activities. Those that put up the boundaries around the box are the ones sucking the vig off. Those are the ones making the money. That's Davos. That's the City of London. That's whoever you want to call it. That's the CCP. That's the American government. That's the CIA. I don't care. Pick the group you hate the most. But they're the ones that set up the boundary conditions. And then they tell you, oh, operate under free market principles. Well, obviously, why is that? Because they've set up the boundaries such that they know exactly what policies to put in place to suck the maximum amount of profit, unearned wealth for themselves, otherwise known as rent, and then use that to continue to decide where the boundary conditions of the box are going to be. Now, every once in a while, quantum mechanics teaches us, just to extend the metaphor, not that I think it's wholly applicable, but let's play with it, which is that when you solve the Schrodinger equation for the position and the momentum of the particle in the box, you find that there's probabilities where sometimes the particle lies outside the box. If the box is the universe, and that's the basic conundrum of, like, quantum mechanics immediately tells you, like everything we think we know about how the universe operates is false. In a Newtonian sense, is false. Like, and the hard part about teaching people these lessons, and I think that they get it now, but when I was taught all this stuff back in, you know, the early 90s, when I was taking physical chemistry, you know, it was very difficult for people to get it. We're 30 years on now. We've gotten, like, all sorts of really good stories using quantum mechanics as a conceit, and, you know, and whatnot. So the understanding of this is a lot better than it used to be. But the truth of the matter is that at the end of the day, we still want to believe that as my professor put it at the time, the problem with learning quantum mechanics is that we don't play quantum baseball. Right. By Newtonian baseball. It's very predictable in that respect. Quantum mechanics, on the other hand, in many ways isn't. And it teaches you different things about how the universe operates. So what I'm getting at here is that what we have to realize is that those probabilities that are outside the box tell us that maybe our theories are wrong. Mm-hmm. And we have to deal with the world as it is, as opposed to the world as someone is trying to tell us that it is. And so maybe, just maybe, we free marketeers have been sold a pig and a poke in the context of a world with central banks, welfare states, nation states, kings, queens, all this rotten nonsense. Mm-hmm. And do I believe that, you know, acting on free market principles as much as possible and understanding those things as is true and correct, and we should strive towards them? Yes. But is it always the right decision to make? Because sometimes the path to a better future is by going left versus right. Even though we've got to go right to get there, sometimes you got to deviate off the path to get there. And that's, in effect, what Trump is doing with a lot of these things. I don't agree with everything that he's doing, but I understand the basic strategy of resetting the game board, driving down those barriers and reshaping the box, mm-hmm, for the global economy away from those who have been setting the rules to those who should make the rules, which is us.
Yeah.
And it's a different, or at the very least, it's going to be a different class of oligarchs. That's the big question now. In the commentary space, you have the kind of Whitney Webb corner of the universe, which says, oh, they're just going to replace Davos with a different set of tech oligarchs, and it's all going to be meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Well, Well, that's maybe true. And it may not be true. So you really do think that in that Curtis Yarvin is equivalent to inbred evil fucking Jacob Rothschild? That's nice, but I don't see that. I see these as two different two people with completely different sets of priorities, imprinting, incentives, parameters, philosophies, behavior, all of it. You know, that's the tough part about history. People are complicated. And nuances, you know, tough. Sorry, Spurred boys, that's the way it works. And I hate to be fucking blunt like that about it and dismissive, but it really gets me angry because that kind of analysis precludes us actually having rational conversations about what's actually goddamn happening.
Right.
And that's where the frustration, I would like to have a reasonable chat with a lot of these people about these things, but I can't because they don't know how to.
Yeah.
Because their intellectual curiosity stops at their confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm.
And they hate, and they'll all say the same thing about me, which is that I have my confirmation bias. That is completely true. But at least I'm willing to, you know, entertain all of these things from different facets and then try and craft the solution, try to understand why is he doing that? He's doing that because of these things. Why are why did the tech bros move in and help Donald Trump get elected? Because they saw an opportunity to implement their version of the future, which looks to me fundamentally different than the one we've been living on. I don't see Elon Musk wanting to go out there and sacrifice, you know, a couple of million slobs so that city of London can get a hold of Russian titanium, oil, and gas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that. I think that's pretty clear. He might want to stick a chip in my head and go to Mars, but, you know, I also don't think he diddles kids either. So, here's your choice. Like, if you think that these two groups of people are morally equivalent, well, I think you have daddy issues, like, frankly, or mommy issues. And I think you need therapy.
Yeah.
Like, at least I admit that I'm in therapy, mostly to keep my to keep this under control so that I can actually explain this stuff without really, like, losing my mind, right?
Right.
So, that's the long answer. But it gives the context of how everything has been shaped in the media. So now everything we think we've been told about how tariffs work, what they're going to do and everything else. Now you have to assess who's telling you that and what's their angle and why do they not like tariffs? Maybe it's because it's their book they're talking. Did you ever think of that one? Like all of a sudden, like I asked Clint Russell the other day on Twitter when he was going off, and I like Clinton. I've been on his show, and I consider him a friend, and he's one of the few people in this particular intellectual space who gets it. And, you know, I'm like, they're all complaining about the budget bill because it's going to supposedly add to the deficit. I innocently just asked a very simple question. Why, if we're all such, you know, good card-carrying libertarians and skeptics, we've been skeptical of every damn government statistic they've ever printed for the last 40 years. Why all of a sudden are we using the CBO's assessment of this bill as gospel truth, as of what it's going to do? Mm-hmm. I thought the whole goal was to lower taxes, which clearly the bill wants to do. We can fix the fiscal side, especially when you look at the situation and realize that Trump has a 3-seat majority in the House. At best, and he really has a minority in the House when you factor in whose toes he's stepping on.
Mm-hmm.
And a 2-3 seat majority in the Senate, again, you know, de facto, but not, or de jure, but not de facto. He's got 53 Republicans, but 6 of them are Democrats.
Right.
And you got 30 members of the House that, you know, Republican members of the House had to, you know, held the line on the bill over the salt tax deduction because they're from fucking upstate New York. It's kind of complicated. And their donors in their districts are like, I'm a 2-20 carrying interest guy that makes fucking $6 million a year. And I want to write off my and I want a tax deduction on my New York State income taxes. Like, and he listens to those people. So at some point you got to like, okay, we did the best we could. Fine, $40,000 as opposed to $10,000. Am I happy about it? No. But at least it's, at least you realize that there are people on Capitol Hill actually willing to make good deals, and they won't, as Dexter White put it to me recently, they're not willing to shit the bed in order to, win an argument.
Yeah.
And it's just like, politics isn't a debate club, folks. We're not, arguing over semicolons and the latest change to the Libertarian State Party Constitution, whether it should be a semicolon or a comma. I've literally been in these conversations with these people for a fucking hour and a half. That's why I left the party 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So the point being is that, Trump's trying to build something new. And our enemies, Davos, City of London, whatever you want to call them, are clearly creating narratives in social media, the traditional media, or the, the undead media, and everything else. What are they trying to do? Well, they're trying to cleave off as much of his support on wedge issues that they know that they can, like get the libertarians, for example, to abreact over deficit spending. It's easy. Like, it's the easiest thing in the world. Like, they don't even have to get up in the morning to do that. They can have an AI write that algorithm for them. Like, that doesn't even get GCHQ out of fucking bed anymore, right? Or the CIA or whoever else, whoever you think it is. Like, it's the tougher ones. It's the guys in the bond market. It's the guys who are, it's the financial guys who have also been really sold, just enough macroeconomics to get the wrong answers. Those are the guys that you really have, because they don't know what to do, because now the world is different. So I get long-winded answer, and Andy, as always, because I can't help myself, but
it's a good answer.
Yeah. But the reality is that it's a very complicated information space, and Sol, I think, is the model in many ways, which is to say, I have my principles, I have my theories, and then here's the data.
Yeah.
We'll see if it, and again, going back to the inflation thing, do I think inflation is going to stay low in this environment? No, because I think oil is fundamentally underpriced.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. And so for that reason, but I got news for you. Oil prices can go to $75 a barrel. Gasoline or RBOB gasoline futures can move from 210 or 212 a gallon to 230 a gallon. Gas prices here in Florida will go back up over $3 a gallon. Inflation will go up. And guess what? You'll see. I'll tell you exactly what you'll see. You'll see the Financial Times, the New York Times, the London Times, the Economist, the ECB, and everybody and every punter on CNBC and Bloomberg screaming at you that Trump's tariffs have caused the inflation. When it's simply a matter of the economy got used to $65 a barrel oil. Now it's $75 a barrel, and Bob's your uncle.
Yeah.
And people who fall for this shit, they fall for it because they want to believe that, because they need to be right as opposed to fixing anything.
Right.
I don't have a need to be right. I just am.
I think you are right.
And I'm being a douche, but I'm kind of doing it on purpose. Like, to remind everybody who's, I'm not busting my hand, patting myself on the back. I'm just like, I've been right about everything.
Yeah.
I haven't been right about the euro. I haven't been right about everything, but I've been right about the grand.
Well, I think you're right on the grand scheme.
Yeah.
I really do.
Right. Everything else falls.
And this really happened. I don't know. It's been about a year since we first spoke. And two things I want to work out a little bit more with you. I guess somewhat of the frustration that I'm feeling, not frustration is the wrong word, but I see the genius in it. And I'm actually, dare I say, supportive of it. And this goes with tariffs. I see this as a negotiation, which it seems like everybody forgot. But also, I don't want taxes. Don't want taxes. Who knows, right? But here's the deal. If you're going to give me the choice, and I think it should be the choice, if you're going to give me the choice of either lowering my taxes or eliminating my taxes with a tariff, which is also a tax, I'm going to take tariffs every single time.
Yeah, me too. Philosophically, I don't think my labor should be taxed. Like, let's just go back. Let's just go back to primitives. Like, who the fuck is the government to tell me that they own my, as Ron Paul would put it, 100% of my labor that I get to keep 90% of? He's right. Now, indirect taxation, you know, again, are we anarchists? Yeah, philosophically. Do we live in a world where we can afford to do that? No, like, if we did that, the CCP would be in here tomorrow. We could get taken over by Canada. I just left Canada, and I can tell you that, I mean, I love Canadians, don't get me wrong, this is going to sound terrible, but I don't want to be ruled by them, and I don't want to be taken over by people, frankly, that lame from that perspective. Like, that's what we're dealing with. But the worst part about it is that we were ruled by people even lamer than the average Canadian for 4 years under the Biden junta. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be ruled by Mexicans either. Hell, I don't want to be ruled by people from California.
Right.
And we have been there. And those people are far lamer than anything that exists in the greater Toronto area. Like, I say that all with love, folks. I met unbelievable people out in Alberta. Like, I love Albertans. Like, they're like Floridians with a different accent. The people are great. Don't get me wrong. I'm this is a little bit of performative thing here this morning. Like, there's a lot going on, but, you know, like, any more than I don't think that Canadians don't want to be ruled by Americans because they think we're lame, and they're probably right. That's the point. It's like, we live in a world where there are different cultures, there are different ideology, there are different, you know, ethoses, and people should be mostly free to express that ethos. And if it means that they have to institute a freaking government in order to do that as an interstitial step to some kind of, you know, libertopia, well, you know, get over yourself. Okay. Right. I'm just not here to argue that in 2025, because that's not the world we live in. We don't have a crop of humans on the planet today that believe in that.
Yeah.
We just don't. What we have are a bunch of, you know, what we have are a lot of people with oppositional defiance disorder, LARPing as, you know, political commentators.
Right. So you made the comment when we last spoke, and I'm going from memory here. I think it was last December, if my memory serves me correctly. And I want to talk about the bond market in a second.
Sure.
But you see money flowing back into the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
And it's already happening. Well, that's the thing. It's already happening. And you didn't, for all of our viewers and listeners, you have no idea that I was going to say this, but well done. And you were right. Mm. It's already starting to happen. What does that look like moving forward from here, do you think? And then we'll talk about the bond market.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go back to when I
met you and Martin Armstrong. I want to give out a shout to him. Both.
Yeah. No, Marty's been great. And I had the great privilege of spending a lot of time with Marty when we were up in Calgary. Credit to Sean Newman for getting him out there. And then I spent a lot of time with Marty. And we did a podcast for Sean. I had dinner with him a couple of times. He came to our event the day after the conference. It was all very good. And Marty and I talk about a lot of this stuff. And what I'll say is the following. We came at this from different perspectives, right? Marty's got Socrates and, you know, his wealth of trading experience and understanding of the global capital flows and everything else, which he taught to me. After a while, I just looked at it and I said, if the United States stops acting like they are trying to liquidate, the leadership of the United States stops acting like they're trying to liquidate the country on behalf of somebody else. I happen to think it's mostly Europe. Dexter White happens to think it's Chinese. You can pick your poison. I don't really care. It does not matter. And they start acting for themselves to protect the country. That's all that'll take. Because the world, I kept saying, the world wants the United States to lead.
Yeah.
Global capital would prefer us to lead in the future because we have the best legal system, the best business environment legally, the best taxation system. We're the biggest offshore tax haven in the world relative to everybody else. All of those things that, you know, the OECD and all the Eurocrats and all the shitbag communists over in Brussels, you know, complain about all the time. You know, and they're very stentorious and proper and everything. And we're, you know, we're a bunch of loudmouth Yanks and we're right and they're wrong. And I don't give a shit that, you know, they play better to boomers. I don't give a shit. I just want to, I want a better world. And all I ever said was, if we start acting like rational human beings, we start acting in our own best interest, the world's going to beat a path to our door because it doesn't make any sense otherwise. All we really had to do was like raise interest rates and say, look, we're going to try and fix the fiscal problem side of the problem and then actually take steps to do so. And the world will, and you don't think we can't attract $6 or $8 trillion worth of investment capital? Really? You don't think that? Like, that's nice, you know? And you don't think you're gaslit either by morons over in Davos. You're out of your mind. Of course you are. But no one wants to think they're gaslit. No one wants to think that they're not wise. No one wants to see themselves as the villain of their story that they've concocted for themselves. Me either. Mm-hmm. Right? I know. Well, it's just, why do you think I work so damn hard? Because I don't want to be that guy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not, you know, look, if you're going to like put yourself out on the limb, and you're going to like do podcasts like this, and you're going to like try and sell yourself as some kind of market commentator or political commentator worth the shit, you have to be right. You can't just, you know, say things that people agree with and then, you know, build a business grifting off of that. And, you know, when you get to be a stop clock twice a day, you know, like that doesn't work. You got, you know, you got to be better at it. So I was thinking about this a lot the other night, like off camera. I was just like having a cigar, sitting, and I was just thinking about it. And I'm like, you know, why do you act the way you do? Why do you work so damn hard? You know, since this was like the first, after the conference in Calgary, my wife and I spent a week there. It was my first real vacation in 6 years. I'm not kidding. And the last time I took a vacation that long, I worked during most of it. I worked 4 hours a day on my vacation every day and then went out in the afternoon to consider myself that I was on vacation. It was insane. I think I took one day off, camped on top of a mountain in northern New Mexico, worried about bears at 11,000 feet. It was insane. But that being said, like I've been thinking about it a lot, and like, and it's because, you know, if you're going to do this, you have to fully commit body, mind, spirit, and all of it. And in order to present arguments that are correct and then inspire other people to help you in your task and your goal. In the case of my goal, it's a better understanding of how to do this so that I can give people good information, sometimes entertainingly and sometimes not. And, you know, and push the ball forward into the future. But, you know, I would have never done this on my own if I didn't look like and care that I was on that kind of mission that way, where this is my ethos, then you wouldn't inspire other people to say, hey, by the way, did you see this? No, I didn't see that. That's really interesting. Thank you for that. And, you know, generously keep inviting alternative points of view into your information space so that you can make better conclusions and, you know, and then present
them.
Well,
on the record, you've done that for me. You've done that for me. You really have. And I just find it interesting. It really changed my point of view. I see, again, the money. It's already happening, and I see the money flowing here. What does that look like if Trump gets what he wants? Meaning, and I see it as money flowing. He was just over in the Middle East raising a bunch of money.
I know. What does it look like in the long term? This is where Martin's warnings are trenchant, I think is the best word for it. Which is that you invite too much capital and you make the dollar too strong, mm-hmm. you've got a problem, yeah. Right? So to Brent Johnson's point that he made, I think when he made it up when he was on my podcast, he also published it on Twitter a couple of days before, which is that showing a chart of like, look, the dollar going up is de-dollarization. The dollar going down is re-dollarization. And, you know, in like a TLDR, meaning if the dollar gets more expensive to use, people will look for alternatives for something else, right? Mm-hmm. This is part of the argument about tariffs. But again, it's not a one-to-one argument, okay? Mm-hmm. Like, this is the thing. It's really funny. Again, I'm a big scientist guy. Like, I've studied all this stuff. So it's really, I watch it. I think it's really funny when people try to make simple rate arguments, linear rate arguments for multivariate systems that cannot be reduced to single variables. So everybody wants to make what effectively is an Arrhenius argument about tariffs or taxes or this or that or anything else. These are Malthusian style arguments of, I'm going to pull this one variable. I'm going to slide the right. I'm going to push the slider on Excel all the way to the right. I'm going to, you know, take the number. I'm going to go from five. It looks like this at five. Here's the equation. That means that at 50, it's going to look like this and it's going to be catastrophic. That's bullshit. That's complete Malthusian thinking. Martin Armstrong's tremendous contribution to the conversation space to say, no, everything's cyclical. To remind you that the law of diminishing marginal utility, hits everybody's, everybody affects everybody's behavior because it is ultimately what we do. So at some point, there's going to be a change in the behavior. The more of something you acquire, the more of something that you do, the more of that behavior you engage in. At some point, the juice is not going to be worth the squeeze, and then it's going to go, and then we're going to go back the other direction. It doesn't matter what it is. So that's the biggest thing that I think we have to fight. And so I find it really funny that, everybody's making an Arrhenius style one over temperature rate, linear rate discussion when the world doesn't work that way. Now in physical sciences, 95 or 98% of physical reactions are Arrhenius based. The very rate is determined one over temperature, right? To the inverse of the one over the natural log of the temperature, but you know what I mean? It's inversely proportional to the temperature in a half log kind of way. But in human interactions with large numbers of particles operating inside the box, oh no, that's a billions of degrees of freedom problem that cannot be solved with vector mass. Okay, right. So you're not using differential equations. You're not using any kind of, that math does not work, period. In fact, because that is so insane, we had to create an entirely new form of mathematics, chaos mathematics, which I will admit I know very little about, but in order to try and model those interactions. I think this is kind of the intellectual divide that a lot of people have to get past is like, when is this appropriate, that the style of analysis appropriate? When is that style of analysis appropriate? In the physical sciences, Arrhenius is, when someone's trying to sell you on a physical process, i.e. climate change and CO2, and they're trying to make a non-Arrhenius argument for CO2 forcing or something like that, that's when you know they're fucking lying to you. When they're trying to make an Arrhenius style or style argument in human behavior and economics, now they're engaging in Malthusian thinking. That's equivalent levels of bullshit. And I think that's the best way I can describe it, given, at this point in time, because I'm literally, I'll be honest with you, Andy, I'm kind of making this up, this argument up on the fly here. Like I've never parsed it that way up until this conversation, which is what I love about doing podcasts like this. Cause my brain gets fired off and I get to go in a different direction to try and explain what we have already explained before in a different way that people can then hopefully a different group of people will get. Like that's ultimately the point here. So the future is not settled. So Trump has to bring it all the way back to the original question now that I remembered what it is. The question is, what's it going to look like in the future? Well, that's the danger. The danger is that Trump could invite so much capital into the United States that it raises, the general price level, and it raises the demand for capital and money and resources and everything else, that we wind up with a dollar that's overly strong, and then we don't have good import-export balances. But then again, if you're working at a tariff level, a general tariff level, then you can adjust the tariffs accordingly. Like that's the thing. The other thing to note, and this is something that Thomas Sowell did not bring up when going back to tariffs. He used tariffs strategically. to get the deals that he wanted. But he still left like the general 10% tariff in place. Oh, by the way, did anybody not notice that everyone's going to get a 10 or 20% tariff depending on who they are?
Yeah. Yep.
Which fundamentally changes the way the United States does business.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing he needs to do is inviting that capital in, taking a profit off of it, having a separate form of accounting. And I think we should get into the sovereign wealth fund. And this is why the sovereign wealth fund is important. Moving assets onto the balance sheet, monetizing them, making them active investments is another way that we're going to be able to change the way we fund internal operations in the United States, how we'll be able to deal with Social Security, Medicaid, and everything else. I think eventually they're going to be all taken off the general budget and moved onto the and be paid out of profits from the sovereign wealth fund. 4 to 6 years from now, the problem will solve itself, and all the CBO budget projections that Thomas Massie and the rest of them are all fucking complaining about will be a thing of the past.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. That's
where I think we're going.
I'm glad you brought up the sovereign wealth fund. I want to get to that. Oh gosh. I mean, we both go on for 3 hours, but we could. Oh my gosh. So
sorry about that. No, it's a fire hose. Sometimes I know that I can't help it. It is what I do.
I'm writing down, but it's so stimulating. But before we get to the sovereign wealth fund, before we get to the bond market, you brought up a huge point, the dollar. So I have come into the camp, and you were part of this, but it wasn't just you. The dollar's not going away. And when money flows, because nobody else has the infrastructure that we have, nobody else has the banking. Yeah, it's not going away.
Which hard one argument for me, dude. I resisted this for like 7 years. From like 2008 to late 2015, when I was working for Newsmax, and everything I was doing at Newsmax, my newsletter was failing left and right. And for the first 2 years I was there, I was like, yeah, we're going to have to go back and dig in ditches. I was at that moment, and I had that moment. I'm like, you know, Marty's right. Dollar's not going anywhere. And I realized it, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, no, but it's interesting to me because if you see money flowing here, you just brought up a great point. The dollar getting too strong.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see with all of that? And then I'm going to throw in gold there, because most people had this wrong, and I had it wrong as well, because they thought the gold and dollar were inversely related, but they're not. If you look past the past 25 years, they're actually very well correlated. My tongue's twisted. So work those two things out with me.
Yeah, well, people move to hard assets.
It's just it.
I hate to break it to folks, but the dollar is not as hard an asset as gold or Bitcoin, but it's, relatively speaking, it's the hardest asset in the room with the most liquidity.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, hate to break it to folks, but, you know, sorry, Peter Schiff, but we're not going to $50,000 gold, and the dollar's not going the way of the dodo, and the European Union is going to like collapse.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm sorry, you're wrong, and you've been wrong for a long, long time. And it's right there. It's right in front of you. And everybody like, oh my God, the dollar index is below 100. Like, yeah, well, it's too strong at 114.
Yeah.
And now it's 100, and re-dollarization is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, at 4.5% Fed funds rate.
Right.
Not at zero.
Right.
Like, I was having a conversation with a patron yesterday about Japan. I made the mistake of using the wrong language to describe what I thought was happening between the US, Japan, and Europe and everything else. And I overstated things on Twitter just a little bit, and he took me to task for it. Fair enough. I had to remind him, hey, by the way, public me is not the same as, you know, private me. It's not exactly the same person. I like to be a dick on Twitter on purpose, and I sometimes just dash shit off at, you know, that and say things in ways that it's not actually accurate. But we were having this argument about Japan, and it was one of those moments where, look, the story about what's happening with Japan, what's happening with the United States, like they're intricately, they're tied at the hip. Europe doesn't have any cards to play anymore. The Trump administration and the Fed have shut off their access to liquidity. The ECB is now out there complaining that they may not have any in the future. I'm like, yeah. But the, here we are, 4.5% interest rates. Everybody thought Japan was already going to implode when, this started to move. Like they're finally getting the 40-year bond in Japan somewhere close to the inflation rate.
Right.
Like, and the
was that bad?
Question, and this was the argument started where I overstated things, but then we came to the, then we made nice and we talked back and forth to each other and everything else. And we got about halfway through the conversation. And he said, if you really look at it, he said it. He's like, if you look at it, like Bessent, Powell and Ueda over at the DOJ seem to be threading the needle. They're able to raise interest rates and not destroy their currencies, not destroy their bond markets, not destroy their stock markets. They seem to be threading the needle on this. And to his credit, he's like, and I didn't think they could do it, And this is the guy who educated me about Japan, because I used to have a much different view of Japan than I do now. And I respect his opinion tremendously. He's one of the most valuable members of my community. But once he explained Japan to me in a way that I understood, I'm like, oh, Japan's going to be fine. Fed's going to be fine. He's like, well, I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm okay. We'll play it out. And we did. And he's like, yeah, I think they seem to be pulling it off. I'm like, yeah, they do. And I know a lot of people don't get that because they're seeing the long end of the yield curve rise and they're seeing, they're seeing the yield curve inversion in the United States. I've got an answer for that one, but there is no yield curve inversion on the Japanese yield curve, by the way. It looks pretty good. It's not increasing in convexity, and it needs a bulge in the middle. Is the belly of the curve a little lower than it should be? Yeah, okay. But again, there are carry trades that need to be unwound here. There are complicated carry trades between the United States, Europe, and Japan that need to be unwound. Okay. There are, as we move towards a different system where gold and Bitcoin are going to be used to help collateralize the treasury market in both the United States, and then everybody else is moving to that system as well, because central banks are now, 20% of the gold market? That's where the scramble is, right? And that's what's actually sending gold up in relative terms. Those things need to be unwound. So now let's talk about what's happening in the bond market. Let's go back to Liberation Day tariff tantrum.
Yes, but I want to... Yes, let's talk about what's going on in the bond market, both the U.S. and the Japanese bond market.
Okay.
If
I didn't fully answer your question, go ahead and bring me back in line.
You did. And I'm thinking.
Fair enough.
My mind is thinking, and yes. But let's talk about the bond market. So what's going on? And it's kind of scary, no?
No, it really isn't. It's not. Because... for 3 years, the Europeans have been loading up on American sovereign debt. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of that is probably Chinese money that's credited to Belgium at Euroclear, but not the Caymans, not the British Virgin Islands,
right?
Not Ireland, not Canada, not this, not no. Okay. $1.1 trillion net as of the last TIC report, probably a little bit more than that. I haven't actually done the May report yet. About a vacation, sorry. And they were all the big buyers. I found it interesting that Luke Roman was trying to saw that and then tried to paint some kind of bad picture for the United States. I'm like, excuse me. This is exactly what I've been saying for the last 3.5 years. It's nothing new. Now, that was the May report was for March, right? Because the TIC report is 2 months in arrears. So we won't see what the Europeans did in April. Now we have Mark Carney took all but took credit for bombing the U.S. bond market during the tariff tantrum. It was mostly an attack on SOFR and the SOFR strip versus from 6 months to 3 years out, as opposed to versus the 10-year. That was the trade. If you're not sure, if you don't believe me on that, which a lot of people will not, and that's fine, but you can go look the data up yourselves, folks. You can go to the CME website and you can go look and you can go in like I did and look at the 2-hour chart of the 3 months over futures curve for December 2025 or March 2026 or whatever. You can go look in there, and on those days when there was the most stress, the amount of volume that was dumped into that market and the volatility that we saw in that market. These are markets that shouldn't move more than 2, 3, 4 basis points a day. We're moving 25 basis points every 2 hours on 10 times normal volume, 15, 20, 30 times normal volume. Someone was attacking SOFR and they failed. And they failed hard. Because all Trump had to do was go, tariffs are, I'll take tariffs off. Ask the question whether or not they did this on purpose in order to induce the attack, in order to trap them, liquidate a whole bunch of their holdings, try and break our markets, and then fuck them in the ass. Because that's what I think they did. Mm-hmm. At the time, I didn't say that. But in hindsight, it's pretty obvious that it may have been it's not obvious, plausible that it was one of two scenarios. Either they were retaliating for the tariffs by attacking the U.S. bond market and the U.S. SOFR market in order to try and blow it up.
Yeah.
Or Trump and Bessent knew that they were going to do that and did it anyway in order to induce the attack, to get a bunch of liquidation in order to flush out who their real enemies were.
Yeah. And both can be true. No.
Both can be true. Both can be true simultaneously.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm kind of on that side. I think both are true.
I'm coming to that conclusion as well. I refuse to. I mean, I know what I would prefer to think, which is, as the gamer in me, I'm like I'm playing Dune here. Like, oh no, I did that on purpose, dude. I'm sitting here with the weather control card the entire time. I was just waiting for you to attack. Freaking Arakeen. I was gonna. I was taking your ass out and then moving in where all your troops from the tanks. I've done that, and I made an alliance with somebody else behind the scenes that you don't know anything about. I've done this, and it's fun, and it's terrible, and it's horrible, and everybody except one. You just told. I like winning. It's a fault. I'm not gonna argue. And then they have to look at me 2 days later. That was really freaking good. That was a great play.
Yeah,
it kind of was. But that being said, they didn't speak to me for 2 days, and then they get like,
and then your best friend.
My point being is that that could be true, but that's the first part of the story. So they attacked the SOFR strip, that trade, they failed. SOFR proved again for the first time that. As the dollar's debt indexing rate, that it was put under a tremendous amount of stress and it passed the test. So again, to the point of why would Trump and Bessent invite that? Well, maybe they needed to find out. And Powell and everybody else, maybe they needed to find out.
Yeah.
But how far the system could be pushed before, it blows up.
Yeah.
And then we find out a couple days ago, I think Bloomberg finally put out a report that the Fed dumped like $46 billion worth of temporary liquidity into the domestic banks, which is what's supposed to do. So it wasn't without cost.
Yeah.
But it's what the Fed is supposed to do, which is to protect our banks.
Well, that's it. I mean,
that's what the Fed's supposed to do, right? So that's the first part of the equation. The second, now note a month later, they couldn't attack SOFR. They can dump, they can force everybody into dumping bonds and all this other stuff. So what do they do next? They get Moody's to downgrade the United States, and then they start the media blitz that Japan is in trouble. They purposefully use the budget talks in Japan to purposefully write false fucking headlines. I caught on this. We'll cop to this. Again, in that conversation I had with my patron about this, he set me straight on this. I got caught because I didn't have enough time to read the articles about this. I was traveling and everything else. I just saw the headlines and I reacted to the headlines that Ishiba, the prime minister, compared Japan to Greece and, you know, they're in serious trouble. And I'm like, well, that felt out of character for what I know about Ishiba and how Japan has been at the forefront of being on board with Trump's plans. Mm-hmm. And so there was a coordinated media attack over that weekend into Monday to, you know, because we have Holiday Inn Express politics and financial commentary in the United States. Everybody's a newly minted freaking Japan carry trade expert because they stayed at a fucking Holiday Inn Express last night. Boom, they were attacking the Japanese, the long end of the Japanese yield curve. Mm-hmm. And what's that going to do? Well, it's probably going to, I don't know the structure of the market, but I'm going to say they would make that move to attack the U.S. bond market through their proxy, Japan, through its proxy, Japan. Makes sense. Yeah. I'm not saying it's true. I'm saying that tracks with what I understand. It tracks with the incentives. It tracks with the situation. It tracks with the fact that that Trump just signed a whole bunch of trade deals that they didn't want, is winding down Ukraine, is negotiating. This is all happening while he's supposed to take a phone call with Putin. Like, everything's happening. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you attacked. Of course you attacked the American bond market while all this other stuff is going on. And remember, they're selling 30s and 10s, and they're buying 2s and 3s.
Yeah.
1s and 2s. Why? To create the inversion in the yield curve so that, you know, the yield on the 1 and the 2 drop, the 10 and the 30 rise, you get the inversion, and everybody's been trained to go, recession? Tariffs bad, and then everybody abreacts to it like clockwork.
Yeah.
And you all fall for it over and over and over and over again because you refuse to accept the fact that in this moment in time, our markets are fake and gay and the central banks are in control of them.
Yeah.
Because they have control of the liquidity at the margin and they know the algorithms that are actually doing the trading. Mm-hmm. And every day that but here's the problem with tools like that. And this is the important part. Every time they do that and they fail, another person goes, okay, this doesn't make any fucking sense. What the hell just happened? And another one, and another one, and another one, another fund manager, another family office operator, another pension fund guy, and blah, 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 blah. And eventually you have to realize that sometimes here's the metaphor for you. Why is there no air war in Ukraine other than drones? Because
that's a great question.
We don't want to find out that the Russians can shoot down our F-16s with competent pilots and advanced avionics, and the Russians counter don't want to prove that they can't. So no one risks anything. And these weapons aren't brought to bear because the weapons are the threat. Okay, there's your metaphor. Same thing in the financial markets.
Yeah.
So you have a weapon. You got $4 trillion worth of U.S. treasuries collectively on Europe's balance sheet that they can use as a weapon. What if that turns out to be, what if they use that weapon thinking it's financial nuclear war and it turns out to be a small pile of TNT and C4.
Yeah, dead.
Oops. Just a kerfuffle.
Right. You know,
did we just find that out over the last 6 weeks?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a question worth considering. My point to everybody that I've called out in this podcast, it's a question worth really considering. And I don't mean run it through your standard filter. I mean, recalibrate your filters. We all need to level up our ability to analyze what's happening in real time. We all need to be better at this. Me, Andy, everyone.
Yeah.
And I only see about 10% of the commentary at really trying to level up. And I see the most of them are just not getting it. And
I completely agree with you.
Recalibrate. The same noise that I saw 3 years ago.
Yeah. And it really works well. Everything that you just said, again, with money flowing, with leverage politics and the money flowing back to the U.S. It just works really, really well with that. Let's talk about two things.
Sure.
Gold's role in all of this, and then you brought up such a great point that I really want to hit on, is the sovereign wealth fund. And I want to talk about gold first, but this was a debate with my own community and group, a strong debate. And at first I was agnostic, and then I was against it. Now I'm almost for it. A sovereign wealth fund. The libertarian in me was like, no, it can never be any good. But I'm actually very open to the idea right now.
You have to be.
And you
the United States great... government isn't going anywhere. We have a savings account. Like, well, right? I mean, we have all these assets that have been written down on our balance sheet, collective balance sheet of the country, to zero. Would they be better served as productive private property and everything else? Sure. In what context?
Yeah, in what world?
Right? In what world? With what regulatory schema? With what, you know, with what crop remember, Davos still has trillions of dollars worth of stolen wealth over the last 500 freaking years that they've been stealing from us. Oh, we're just going to like throw that shit onto the market for them to scoop up at this point? Because, you know, it's right. Like, I got news for you. You're literally carrying water by making that argument for the very people who want to enslave you. Mm-hmm. And turn your children into, you know, trannies. Okay. Like, I don't want to live in that world. And I'm willing to compromise my libertarian fifis in order to get that done. So I've got a 19-year-old daughter I want to bequeath the freaking world to, and I don't want to bequeath that world to her. Period. Like, you know, she disagrees with me about, you know, even if we have disagreements about what that world should look like, I'm like, that's fine. We'll have that conversation.
Yeah.
For the rest of our lives. And you can be whoever you want to be. But I'm your dad. I'm here to protect you. And guess what? We're fucking Europe in the ass because these people are evil.
Yeah.
Fine. Sorry, honey. It doesn't matter. Like, I don't care. You want, like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, this is where we have to be. And if you can't handle that, then you're not a grown-up.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you're not. You're not a grown-up. And I call people adolescents on this shit all the time. And I'm like, I think it's still the operative word because this is an incredibly important moment in time, Andy. This is why I'm like so hot on this. It's not because it's like, I'm sorry, my time preference has become very high because I can see just over the horizon what these people need to do given the setup in order to try and get out of it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know about you, but I don't want to live in, you know, I don't want to live in the day after.
Yeah. Well, and also you brought up just look at the data, and this is anecdotal, I'm stating data, but I look at all these countries that have sovereign wealth funds, Saudi.
Yeah.
The state of Iowa.
Like, everybody, like, how many, I live just north of Gainesville, friggin' Florida, like shit-lib central, okay? Like, literally shit-lib central. Like, these people are so far gone. They're the ones, like, selling their Teslas and buying Subarus and the whole nine yards. Like, the whole thing. And they all look to Europe and go, why do they have free healthcare? And why do they have free education and everything else? Have you a note? Do you know what the freaking government in Norway does? They sell an awful lot of freaking oil. Mm-hmm. They take a huge, huge royalty out of Statoil.
Yeah.
And then they give that back to the people.
Yeah. Well, that's it.
I mean, but we can't do that because Trump? Go fuck yourself.
Yeah. That's really what brought, look at these other countries. And again, it's a way to take care of what you brought up 30 minutes ago. It's a way to take care of, and this is speculation.
The liability.
Yeah.
The social welfare system.
Why not? It's better than what we have now.
And why would you expect the establishment media and the establishment politicians who created this system in, that we live under today, created all these problems and are pulling massive, massive personal vigs off the off of this gravy train, and have ideologically explained to you who they are and what they are. Mm-hmm. Why would you ever think that they would tell you, oh yeah, what Trump wants to do is a good idea? No, they're only going to tell you that it's a bad idea.
Right.
And they're going to get their useful idiots in the libertarian circles to make the arguments for you.
Yeah.
For you folks. There's a psychological profile on every prominent libertarian in GCHQ and the CIA. There's one on me. Yeah. I know it because I see it in the comments on the podcasts I do. I see it from the people in my community that I suspect are feds. I see it everywhere. Mm-hmm. I know that. You know that. And that's the way they operate. So don't it's not paranoia. This is what they do. They've cut you it for fuck's sake. Mm-hmm. So know that that's the scenario and then use it to your advantage against them. Don't be their tool.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not to the point yet where I believe that like a lot of conservatives, that libertarianism was a CIA construct to rob us all of our most productive years by, you know, arguing about how many Rothbards can dance on the head of a pin. But it's pretty indistinguishable from the reality of the libertarian movement in the United States. Yeah. It could be real. It could be, you know, the art scene from the CIA art scene and all that shit. Because it's the truth. I mean, I've had this conversation on and off with Dexter White for like 30 years.
Yeah.
About Jackson Pollock, everything from Jackson Pollock and Ornette Coleman to Murray Rothbard and everything in between. Like, we've had this conversation about how dangerous this shit's been and how our intelligence services and the Comintern, which never ended, by the way, have done their long march through the institutions, gaslit us for decades, controlled the media space, controlled the broadcast media. Like, there ain't one major entertainment company in the world, in the United States, ABC, CBS, NBC, they were all created during the years and by the OSS. We have to realize that. We can't sit here and indulge our spiritual boomerism and believe that there's a utopia out there somewhere. I'm dead serious. We've got to get through this. You got to get down and dirty. That doesn't mean we have to like embrace Nazis or anything. It doesn't mean we all have to become raging anti-Semites. We just, you know, but that's unfortunately another outgrowth of the extreme overreaction to that insight. No, just stay in the middle and go, yeah, of course they did that. And this is how you counter it.
Yeah.
And you can see it in front of you every day. And admit to yourself that maybe you were played. I can easily admit that I was played.
Yeah.
And well, then I can grow up and I can move on and go, I'm sorry, and issue a mea culpa and move on. This is what Trump does.
Yeah.
This is why they hate him.
Yeah. No, that's a great point, too. I left, if you would call it the Libertarian Party, I left probably 18 months ago, 2 months ago. And it was just from the sense I didn't see it going anywhere. But also, I'm a man without one, but I'm with one, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no,
I'm a spiritual libertarian, but not practically.
I right here in my heart, like, what do I want? I want to be able to live whatever life I want to live and get and stay and get, you know, and be very comfortable saying that property tax is the original sin of government.
Yeah.
Like, good, right? But, you know, I left in 2004 it all didn't happen all at once. I was a member of the executive committee for the state of Florida. I, on a lark, ran for state chair in the middle of the 2004 convention. I put my hand in the air. I lost by one vote. Okay. And I lost to the Republican operative, the GOP operative that had been running the party. And the only reason I didn't win was because I wouldn't pledge to pay my own free and airfare and hotel room and board at the national convention that they wouldn't put out $500 or $1,000 to like put me, you know, like I didn't have a pots of piston or window to throw it out of. Like, no, dude, you're paying me for that. Sorry. Had I been at the 2004 convention, the GOP would not have taken over the party. They would not have destroyed the Libertarian Party platform, because I would have been the chair of the third largest caucus at the convention. And Doug Klippel, who was the chair, fucked this over. Had I been there, the radical, I was deep in my like real anarcho-radical phase. Like, I mean, you think I'm an asshole now? Forget it. 20 years ago? Oh, couldn't have a conversation with me about anything. But I would have held the line against everything.
Yeah.
But I wasn't there. And I left the party 6 months later after I realized that, like, this is not going anywhere. And they're just wasting my time with multiple hour debates about things that are never going to happen. I'm like, I don't care.
Yeah.
We're not going to sit here and argue about voting system, changing the voting system. It's not going to happen. Why are we wasting our time on this? Why aren't we running people for dog catcher? Why aren't we running people for county commission?
Yeah.
Why aren't we trying to win?
Yeah.
Why are we not building anything? And look, we have an intellectual and philosophical movement and political movement that has achieved absolutely nothing practical in 60 years. And anything practical that they've achieved, they've done so through voices that understood how to play enough politics to win.
Yeah. Lovers politics. Let's land the plane here. You're a busy guy and I actually have to leave soon, but land the plane here about gold. When we first spoke, you said, well, gold's very interesting.
Mm.
And it is. In this new world that is coming out, gold's place in this, its central banks are buying it hand over fist. Every dip is bought violently, if you would. And I'm not saying like a price for gold or whatever, and I don't think that's helpful. I think what's helpful is the role. And it seems to me like it's coming back in as a monetary unit that's stable, that not only the banks want.
Well, I saw this morning. This is going to sound like I'm Gish Galloping or like I'm doing the Trumpian week. So this morning, what did we say? Saw a report this morning that the ECB is going to put off implementing the last bits of Basel III until 2027. You know why? Oh, on U.S. regulatory uncertainty. Yeah, this is because I was told 6 months ago that Basel III was dead in the United States.
Wow.
I was told 6 months ago this is true because I have friends who were, you know, work at JP Morgan and other places, and they're like, oh, no, fucking Diamond is dead set against this, and it's not happening. Like, the gold tier one capital asset part of it is already in place for all intents and purposes. They don't have a problem with that. What they have a problem with is the extra capital that the bank, that U.S. banks have to hold as G-SIBs on top of the supplemental leverage ratio, which we've gotten rid of, which is another major source of domestic treasury demand. Somewhere close to $500 billion by best estimates that I've seen. And I talked to Caitlin Long, and credit to Caitlin Long for putting all this, for explaining all that to me in a way that I understood on my podcast. This is episode 213, so 213 of the Gold, Ghosts, and Guns podcast. Caitlin like knocks it out of the park. I'm like, so I was on my
back.
I was on my back foot in this one, folks. That was fun, right? And that rarely happens. And I say that with all love and respect. She's just a fucking powerhouse, that woman. I love her. That Basel III endgame where they were demanding that we have keep even more reserves on bank balance sheets to disadvantage them against European banks was the dividing line. It was never, ever, ever going to pass. And with Trump in power, absolutely not going to pass. What do you think they were trying so hard to push Biden over the finish line and then have him die in office of prostate cancer or whatever? Like, you construct whatever argument you want about, why the Biden, why the Biden thing happened the way it was, but you can clearly see what their plan was. They knew he had prostate cancer. They knew he was terminal, and they ran him anyway, denying everybody. This is my take on it. Dexter White and I
100%, 100%.
Clearly that they were going to have him die in office, sideline Kamala Harris, put their person in charge, and continue running the country. What did they do in Romania? What have they done in Germany? What have they done in England and France? And like it's same thing. So, I've always said that they lost monetary control over the United States. They haven't maintained political control. Now they've lost political control over the United States. They don't have any control at all, and they're all going to wind up in jail. And I know a lot of people are cynical about this, but I'm telling you, Trump and company are making the argument now to the American people that these people were illegitimate and that everything about the Biden administration should be repealed because the man was not compos mentis.
Yeah.
And he wasn't in charge of the, and he wasn't signing the executive orders, and he wasn't running the administration. And that's more important than the Epstein list, folks.
Yeah.
And I will trade the Epstein list 55,000 fucking times
for that
before I give that one up. That's what I'm not giving up. I'll give up the $10,000 SALT deduction cap to get massive tax cuts and deregulation and everything else, and to ensure that, you know, and to get the relisting of Fannie and Freddie, which we haven't even covered yet, which Trump came out yesterday about, I've talked about. I was talking to my contacts I have within OMB, and I'm telling you, they're cutting money they're cutting money left and right, and you can't see it, but they got to get the bill passed. You got to get the budget done so that he can ignore Congress until the midterms. That's what this bill is about. And sometimes you have to take a punch in the mouth and you have to give to get.
Yeah.
The get here is huge. The give is very little.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you cannot understand that, you might be a libertarian. So, I have no fucking patience for it anymore. I just don't. We have this unbelievable opportunity in time to finally roll these people up and destroy them. We haven't even gotten into the geopolitics. We haven't even gotten into rump Europe, rump Ukraine, all of this shit that's happening. Everything he did in the Middle East, he did more in 10 days in the Middle East than anybody thought could be done in 10 years.
Yeah. Right?
Right? So, I mean, we could do 3 hours on Trump and geopolitics and what's happened in the last month since the tariff tantrum, and we still wouldn't get it all done.
Yeah.
So, like, I we're going to wind up, the Democrats could be destroyed. Like, the media can be just, we can destroy it all. And they've got, and it's clearly obvious, like, people like Stephen Miller and Besant and others, they all know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And you're just going to have to it's not trust the plan. It's like, trust the people.
Yeah.
It's right finally, there in front of you.
Finally. Yeah.
Yeah.
So on that, we could go on and on. I would love to have you on again soon to talk, work this out, but you're a high in demand guy. And for all of my listeners and viewers, and there's a lot, Tom is very gracious to me, at least very gracious. So thank you for that.
Andy, I say this with, I love what I do.
Yes, you do.
I love this. Like I love this almost as much as I love my daughter and my wife and my dog, like, you know, and that's high praise.
Yeah.
And it affords me, it's both my own personal therapy session I get to do in public, and I mean, because I would just do it anywhere on my back porch, and then my wife would be like, "Dad, stop talking."
My wife too.
You know, she's like, somebody asked her while we were in Cornish, that we were in Calgary over that weekend. She's like, "They're like, do you ever watch him's podcast?" She's like, "Oh hell no!" No, like, hell no. I get enough of this shit at home. Like, she does. And I love what I do. I love what I'm seeing in the alternative media space. I love what I'm seeing. I see in the podcast space, and it would be boorish, and I'm not above being boorish, but it would be counterproductive, more importantly, if I didn't give as much time to it as possible to help as many people on the same mission and the same path as possible in order to counter the unbelievable number of fucking psyops that we're being gaslit into believing on a daily basis. We have to do this. It's incumbent upon us. And if I've got to sacrifice part of my life to do it, okay, that's my job. I'm in that phase of my life now where this is where my daughter's growing. She's on her own. Like, you know, my wife and I are like trying to, I've got other things I got to do with my time. I've indulged enough of myself over the course of my life. It's all right behind me. So like, and in front of me, you can't see my drum set, which I haven't touched in 2 months, which I need to like literally touch. I've done enough of that, in my life. Now it's time to bear down, do the work, and, make whatever impact you can to make the world a better place. Yeah. And if that means, speaking a few inconvenient truths to people who, are stuck. Well, okay. I give it to you loud and dirty because I think it's the best way to make it stick. Other people use, other people were nicer about it. Okay, whatever. I'm good. There's different strokes.
I like you the way you are. You and Alex Prater and Tom Luongo are my favorite guests. And really the numbers show that.
Yeah, and Alex is one of my favorite people on the planet. And my only complaint about Alex is that he works too hard.
He does. He's a very gracious guy.
He works way too hard.
But I would love to have you on again on the record on this podcast and the show. I'd love to have you on again soon because I know that you're incredibly in demand. But I don't have more fun, but also more than that, just banter and back and just me asking questions. And I just really, really appreciate that. So I'd love to have you on again real soon. So
of course.
Yeah. Tom,
I always have a lot of fun doing these with you, Andy. You're a good host. So I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. So Tom, you don't need any exit, but how do people get in touch with you if they want,
TFL1728 on Twitter or X or whatever they're calling it this week. Patreon/ Gold Goods and Guns if you want to support what we do directly. You can sign up for free and follow. There's like these podcasts that I do. I try to cross post them there as a repository for them as well. TomLuongo.me is the blog, and there's that. And doing the thing.
Okay. I'll post all of that in the show notes, in both the Apple Podcast, the Spotify Podcast, and the YouTube channel. Tom, I got to run. You're a busy guy too. You got to run, but I just want to thank you so much for your time.
No problem, Andy. Anytime.